What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
The beast hide is too thick to be pierced on the outside. I must cut through it from the inside.
Huh? No, Trash! Wait a minute! Trash!
That's Dave Bautista's Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, employing the same strategy to kill a nasty space beast that we, in fact, use to assemble a summer movie preview.
It's true. You just got to get in there and tear the guts out of the thing.
That's how we roll here, yes. That preview coming in the form of our top five questions about the summer movie season, plus a review of Guardians Volume 2 and more ahead on Film Spotting. The big movie news this past week, Josh, the passing of director Jonathan Demme, actually occurred not too long after we taped our last show, so no mention of Demme on that episode, but we plan to rectify that here soon. The Oscar-winning director of Silence of the Lambs, Stop Making Sense, Rachel Getting Married, Philadelphia, and many, many more. From docs, concert docs, features, he did everything, and he passed away at age 73.
Which is not old at all, but Demme in my head was so much younger than that. I think that's just because of the films he made. I mean, last year, his final film, Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, you know, a wonderful concert documentary, one of the movie highlights for me from 2016, and of course, a whole career full of other great stuff.
And we have seen some great writing about that great stuff over the past week from writers like Scott Tobias from The Next Picture Show, Callum Marsh, and others. We may hear some of those voices next week here on the show, as we do plan to honor Jonathan Demme with a review of one of our shared blind spots, the 1986 road trip comedy Something Wild, Jeff Daniels, Melanie Griffith, and Ray Liotta. That has always been one of my big regrets. We will cover that, and we will share whether we're ready or not, whether we have insight or not, we are going to attempt it, our top five Jonathan Demme moments. If you want to contribute to that top five, leave us a short voicemail with your favorite moment from a Demme film or just a general appreciation. The number is 312-264-0744, or you can always just send us an MP3 file, feedback@filmspotting.net. On this week's show, we will get to our summer movie preview and results from one of the closest ever polls in the show's history. Did not see that coming. Film Spotting listeners choose their favorite actress, who happens to be born in 1990.
But first, it's one Earthling, three aliens, and a baby, Groot. Adam and I reviewed the second adventure of Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy.
So we're saving the galaxy again?
Yep.
Awesome! We're really going to be able to jack up our prices for two-time galaxy savers.
Yes!
Josh, your favorite gang is back, the Guardians of the Galaxy.
My favorite gang?
Yeah, favorite gang.
Okay.
We'll get to that here in a moment. Star-Lord, Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista as Drax, and yes, Baby Groot. Josh, you might even call them a family, which we saw them forming at the end.
There's only one movie, Family, Adam, and we all
know
what family that is.
You're darn right. The Fast and the Furious, they are treading on one of my other favorite franchises here.
I could hear Vin Diesel's biceps rippling in dismay at someone else trying to claim the family.
He's not going to stand for it. I think we need to see him versus Drax in some kind of pairing of those two universes. But I don't even know what to say about the plot here. Essentially, you've got this family and their bonds are tested a little bit as we get another family member introduced. It was a key part of the story in Guardians 1. Just who is Star-Lord, Peter Quill's real father? We find out the answer in Volume 2, and not spoiling anything, Kurt Russell factors heavily into this story.
And that's revealed fairly early on, so it really isn't spoiling anything.
Another bit they're stealing straight from The Fast and the Furious. Kurt Russell showing up in these franchises because he makes everything better. Or does he? We'll find out here, Josh, because you were definitely out on an island, not totally alone, but mostly alone, with your reaction to Guardians 1. That movie made over $773 million worldwide. None of those people are reading your reviews, obviously.
Yes.
91% on Rotten Tomatoes. Out of 288 reviews, only 25 negative ones. You were among those, and you just rewatched it. And as you said last week here, we're not motivated to change your mind. So, does Volume 2 right any of the wrongs of the first Guardians? And if not, does it commit the same sins or new ones?
So, I should also say that I was mixed on Guardians of the Galaxy.
You didn't hate it.
It's not like I trashed the thing. I just came down on the wrong side, and there were plenty of things to like about it. Those characters are one of the things. That was a strength of the original. It's still a strength here. The chemistry between the actors is really strong. The characterizations of each individual person on this team is, you could argue, maybe more distinct than the Avengers themselves. So that is carried through here, and I did appreciate that. I mean, some things, you know, I complained about the original being so pop culture referential, and that at what point was it going to stand on its own, or was it just becoming almost like an Entertainment Weekly magazine come to life?
Yeah.
They do that here. I'm worn down by it. Some of those references work. They're funny. They're jokes.
Don't you feel like it's a little less here?
I think
and
it
I
is
haven't
a little
seen
less.
The first one since it came out, so I
think
I can't
it is
compare,
a little less.
But...
And it's at this point kind of embedded in the mythology. Mm-hmm. And I'm not referring to the music. I like how both this film and the original film use hits from the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. They give that an emotional undercurrent and don't just plop it in for the music. Like there's a reason each song is in here.
And okay? Sam Cooke and Cat Stevens, for the record, make everything better. So
this is true.
That's a nice little trick there by James Gunn.
I think it does suffer from similar issues in that, like more than one other Marvel movie, it's too freaking big.
Mm-hmm.
It ends in a way that just expands beyond. I mean, I was almost in a daze for the last 15 to 20 minutes of this thing.
That was just the 3D glasses, though, that we had to watch it with.
The 3D does nothing, as it, you know, rarely does anything. Does nothing for this film. And it's, you know, it's cumulative. It's not that this, without giving anything away, we'll just say we're facing another villain with outrageous powers, doing outrageous things that wreak galaxy-wide, if not universe-wide, havoc. And this isn't handled any more poorly than the dozen of other times I've seen it in a Marvel film. It's just happening yet again. And I think it's particularly exposed in a movie like this, again, because those characters are so ingratiating and compelling. This movie has two interludes, I would say, that do both involve Baby Groot. I mean, you know, Baby Groot dancing, it amuses me not quite as long as I think the movie hopes that it will amuse us.
No.
But the idea behind these two interludes is that all this bombastic fighting and action is placed in the background for a moment of quiet comedy. More than a moment. They pull these out, and I won't give away the second one because it's more in the climax, but the first one is right over the credits where the team is battling the space beastie we heard about, and Groot, Baby Groot, comes up to the speakers that they brought along so they could have a little music while they're fighting, plugs them in, the music starts playing, and he starts dancing, and the camera settles on him, where in the background we see vaguely all the fighting. That is a literal representation of what Marvel movies need to start doing. They need to set aside the bombast and go where their strength is, which generally is in the characterization and the relationship between those characters. This is why Joss Whedon set such a great template for the first Avengers movie, which wasn't perfect by any means, but it had that sense of camaraderie to it. And that's when Guardians of the Galaxy works. And I think it has a few moments like that. But by its final third, at least, this thing just goes completely haywire and characters left by the wayside until they really try to pump up the sentimentality and that family angle you're talking about in a way that I've never believed really in the first film, and I didn't buy it here either.
Okay, so I don't want to spoil anything here for listeners, but you're saying even by the end of this film and all the work it does to provide some sentimental moments, it didn't work on your cold heart at all?
Not at all.
Really?
No, why? It did for you?
Yeah, it did, actually. Oh. And I'm not entirely sure why, though. I think first it labors very hard to do it.
The funeral scene, we won't say whose, but the funeral scene?
The music doesn't hurt. And yes, I did, for whatever reason, respond to that scene. I guess I'm just a softie here, Josh. But it's funny that you single out that opening as an example. You admit maybe it goes on too long, but an example of what all these Marvel movies need to do better. We ultimately agree on this film overall. I maybe am going to come down a little more favorable than you. We'll see how it shakes out. But that opening for me was actually a tough one to get over. Hmm. And it's because not only did I get a little bit tired of watching Baby Groot dance, and look, like anyone else, I'm human. I'm mortal. I'm not a god here, Josh. Baby Groot is adorable.
Pretty cute. Big eyes. Big eyes on Baby Groot.
Great eyes. Everything about the way that character is created is believable and sweet, and I enjoy watching Groot on screen. So setting that aside, all that bombast and all that insanity going on as the other members of the Guardians fight this creature who's coming to get something that they also are coming to get, apparently. All it did for me was make me realize that anytime there's one of these big action sequences, I can basically tune out because there's no stakes at all. No matter how intense it gets,
that's true.
You know that everyone's not just going to be a little bit snarky and having a little bit of fun, which I enjoy about the Guardians movies, but they're basically going to be acting as if there's never really any threat at all. And so that immediately turned me off a little bit. And then, unfortunately, we were watching it in 3D, and I don't know what to make of the film. I don't know what it would be if we were watching it in its normal presentation. But all that did was add to that sense of flimsiness and artificiality, where every time a character was thrown onto something and they landed, I felt like, well, they're just landing on ones and zeros. There's nothing here.
The CGI in here is relentless.
Yeah, which isn't to say it isn't gorgeous on some level, and there aren't times where when you get to, for example, Kurt Russell's planet, you can't be a little bit in awe just as the characters are in awe. You understand all the time and effort that went into this, and again, I think you can appreciate it on some level, but I just keep coming back to that word flimsy, and I think, too, that that extends to the whole film's approach, with one exception, with the exception of one big character, its approach to life and death. In general, there's just so much chaos and so many random people being destroyed along the way or being hurt along the way that, for me, that also just makes me realize, well, who cares about anything that's going on despite my affection for the Guardians themselves?
This is why I don't buy into the sentimentality, is because there is something exceedingly callous about both of these pictures. Mm-hmm. And I know you're going to say, and it is a slippery slope when you start saying, oh, there are too many bodies, because yes, there are many films that I have praised, including other Marvel films.
The original John Wick is full of them.
That have a lot of casualties. But there's something about the swerve this movie makes from an extended sequence of one character has this arrow that just – he whistles and it slices through people. And there's an extended sequence of him doing that to, what, 30, 40, 50 people who were a few scenes ago his compatriots,
right?
There's a lot of role switching in this movie that happens maybe a little bit too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to do that, fine. But then don't give me a 10-minute funeral sequence for a single character at the end of the film and tell me I have to care about that when I sat through a jokey mass murder 20 minutes earlier.
Exactly.
And it's that disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to go back to your point about threat as well, because there's a distinction we should make here. For me, it's okay that they joke around in those scenes and you don't feel like there's much of a threat. As you said, that's part of the fun. The fun is in the jokes they share, that they are being nonchalant about this, that they have this air of invincibility to them, right?
Though you could argue as well that perhaps it's masking their actual fear a little bit.
Yeah,
but
it, maybe it gets into that
is,
a little.
But
those scenes work, and that would be fine. But then don't give us this climax where we're supposed to fear for them all of the sudden. The movie is trying to have it both ways in too many ways.
Here's my other question for you. Has there actually ever been a Stan Lee cameo in one of these films that wasn't obnoxious and annoying?
You're asking the wrong guy, because
I know, I
it went over well
guy.
In the theater.
And I know I'm going to get killed by some listeners out there, but I'd love for them to tell me just one that actually,
for the first couple of times, I think it was cute and amusing. All right. But what's similar for me, and again, if you're not the choice target demo for this, and I think we'd both describe ourselves as being open to Marvel films and being on
100%
record for enjoying quite a bit many of them.
Yes.
But we're not Marvel groupies, okay? At this point, these post-credit things we're getting I feel like I'm in front of a judge and I'm getting my sentences laid out to me.
Well, they undo.
Here is your punishment.
Yeah.
And now you're sentenced to this movie in 1 year. You're sentenced to this movie in 2 years. I mean, did we Three movies are we getting after this?
I don't know. At least.
And that's not counting the next Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, mm-hmm. it's punishing these credit sequences for me. Now, some people, if you can't get enough of this and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 was enjoyable, I mean, those are treats, right? Mm-hmm. Those are bonuses and treats, and I guess I can see that. But, man, is it wearying for me.
Yeah, as I was saying, I just think it undoes a lot of whatever goodwill the end of the film creates for some of us, and it did for me. But then when you start to get to these myriad post-credit sequences that are trying to be funny but aren't funny at all in some cases, or are trying to set up future films but what's going on screen isn't compelling enough to make me care about those future films, then I leave the theater thinking about those moments and not the moments in the film that actually work. This film doesn't solve the main issue that most sequels face, which is proving why it's necessary. You can see it in how hard the movie strains to string together a plot. It all relies on a MacGuffin, essentially, which for me, I think was a little bit disappointing after appreciating the script in Guardians 1. And I do want to go back to our point about the callous attitude, not remembering the film very well, as I said. I still feel like it was a little bit more thoughtful in the way it handled that compared to this film. And maybe it's just because I'm remembering the backstory of Drax, which is really not touched on here at all. And the backstory with Nebula and with Gamora, of course, and their father. So that created this sense that taking life actually matters. That doesn't mean we're not going to get some crazy scenes where people destroy each other, but I felt like that compensated for it, and I didn't really get that here. I think the biggest problem for me with this film, though, Josh, is actually that the humor, while there are a lot of really funny scenes and there are a lot of elements that work, whether they're actual punchlines, they're lines of dialogue, or they are visual gags, and there are many in this film, they're really predictable. You can see every single one of them coming. You know exactly when the music's going to stop, when the camera's going to cut. You know exactly what the joke is all the time. And absent surprises, that banter and all that cleverness really is lacking. That's something I felt that was missing compared to the first film.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's like it's a quarter second too slow.
Yeah.
And in that quarter second, we do, especially if the first film is fresh in your mind, we do see that coming. So it does undercut a lot of the humor. I mean, not to belabor the point, but again, because I did just revisit it, the movie, both movies have this pivot of these characters will talk about the great loss that they've suffered in one scene, and the very next one just be flippantly killing 12 people who may or may not really be that threatening of an adversary.
Yeah.
So again, you know, you might say maybe that they're enacting their own pain out on others, but this movie is not thinking it that deeply. So there is that flippancy that's a through line for both films. I do want to get to, so that I'm not overplaying my disappointment with this and so we don't get hammered by Guardians fans, I want to get to some things that I really did like about the movie.
It's too late.
You know, if you're allowed to you know, like some things and not have to like absolutely everything, I still love watching the character animation that is put to work on the Rocket character.
Mm-hmm.
I just think from the way he bristles and you sense that in his, like, the facial expressions they get out of fur is pretty amazing. Bradley Cooper's voice, we were just talking about this before we started. I mean, it's whatever they're doing to his voice and whatever he's giving, comes together and works. His timing is great.
Yeah.
And I did miss a little bit with Baby Groot. Obviously, it's not exactly Groot before, but there was a real relationship with those two in the first film.
Sure.
And here, it's almost like Rocket doesn't know anything about Baby Groot. That was a little weird, like, gap. But overall, the character animation, if you even notice, like, one side of his, I don't know, do raccoons have beards? Like, one side of his facial fur is a little bit longer and scruffier than the other. And it's these little details. There's a running gag about him trying to wink and he can't get the right eye.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a wonderfully alive character, completely animated, that has as much personality and presence, physical presence on the screen. We're talking about the CGI just being overwhelming here. Whenever Rocket is on the screen, you feel like you could reach out and touch him. And I'll say the same for, there's these early characters, a planet we meet of the Sovereign, they're called.
Yes.
They're wonderfully golden. It's like Goldfinger. Everyone stepped out of Goldfinger, right?
Yeah.
And that's a combination of amazing makeup work and some production design too, where you feel like their planet or their area, their war room that they operate from, takes up a physical space, mm-hmm. even though I'm sure there's a ton of CGI going on there. That makes everything work, whereas what we get to largely on the Kurt Russell character's planet and definitely in that finale is spaceless. Mm-hmm. As you said, they'll just fall and you know they're just going to hit on something because someone will draw it before they land.
Yeah. What else works about the sequences with the Sovereign is Elizabeth Debicki, who is the actress playing the High Priestess, who I loved
so funny
in The Great Gatsby. I wasn't a big fan of that Baz Luhrmann film, but she was a side character, and I loved her every time she was on screen. She'll probably remind a lot of people here of, what's her name?
Emily Blunt.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Emily Blunt. That's who I assumed it was, but, and then later I was like, no, not quite her. But
She's really talented, and there's a precision about her that I think obviously fits this character and that they're all about perfection.
Yeah, and humor too,
yeah, and
right?
humor. And yet, at the same time, there is some humor there. So I really enjoyed her, and those characters, as you said, they were ultimately what made me appreciate the first film just enough. The characters and that chemistry and the performances. And here, I'm battling because despite all these things I've said about the film, it's still a mostly enjoyable time. And the reason is, despite the fact that I think plot-wise, they make a mistake in separating these characters for a long period of time, and we don't really get them as a full group for a good chunk of this running time, that whole dynamic with the snarky, overly cocky Chris Pratt, he's maybe here a little bit more smug than in the first one, and it doesn't quite work as well as it does in the first one, but I still enjoy that character. I like the difference between him and Zoe Saldana's Gamora. Obviously, the ultra-serious character who doesn't show her emotions in contrast to Peter. And then the thing I couldn't believe I loved about the first movie, Drax is a character. I would watch a movie that's just about Drax.
He's pretty great.
You want to talk about timing?
Yeah.
And everything about how he embodies that character. And here we've seen him evolve into a character who actually now does have not just a sense of humor, too much of a sense of humor some ways. But I like that contrast and I like the performance. And you said it, Bradley Cooper. I don't know how much credit to give him, and I don't know why the credit really matters, because it almost seems to me that there's no way he could be doing that voice. So then what are they doing to manipulate it? And then I ask myself, why does that matter? He's giving a performance there. I have joked that it's his best role, and I'm not really going to step down from that, because even though he's fine, but I don't enjoy him any more than I enjoy him as Rocket Raccoon. I enjoy that character, and I think the performance is great. So all of them together, when they are together and when the jokes are clicking, it's a good time.
You know why I did it, Star Munch?
I'm not going to answer, Star Munch.
I did it because I wanted to. What are we even talking about this for? We just had a little man save us by blowing up 50 ships.
How little? Like this?
A little one-inch man saved us.
Well, if he got closer, I'm sure he'd be much larger.
Yeah, that's how eyesight works, you stupid raccoon.
Don't call me a raccoon!
I'm sorry. I took it too far. I meant Trash Panda.
Is that better?
I don't know. It's worse. It's so much worse.
What about Russell? Where you land?
Kurt Russell for me is one of those guys who it hit me as I was listening to him on another podcast, an interview with him, and seeing him again in The Fate of the Furious. I realized that if I could interview any person on Film Spotting, just pick anybody and they would be sitting before me, Kurt Russell would probably be my choice.
You got to have him in studio, though.
Yeah,
right?
You need to be in studio. I couldn't do it. Couldn't do it over the phone. But I just realized I have this connection to him. And this whole franchise so far is built on nostalgia. And so when you throw
in someone
like Kurt Russell, for me as a viewer, I'm immediately flashing back to Kurt Russell of the 80s. And I'm thinking about Big Trouble in Little China and Escape from New York.
Yeah,
and
it's a really nice choice of casting.
And The Thing. And so it works on that level. He's still a compelling presence. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And you can, at least in his attitude, see him as being part of that bloodline that gave us Chris Pratt's character.
After all these years, I've found you.
And who the hell are you?
I figured my rugged good looks would make that obvious. My name is Ego. And I'm your dad, Peter.
Yeah, I think he's good here. I think he's having fun. I think you can feel that. And he brings a knowingness and a sense of humor to it without pushing that too far. His character gets completely lost in what he's required to do in, again, this bombastic finale. And so then you're kind of like, oh, poor Kurt Russell. He's going down in flames like the rest of this thing.
Well, that is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. It is currently playing everywhere, and it's surely going to make probably more than $773 million worldwide, despite our mixed to negative takes on the film. If you see it and agree or disagree with us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Poll time when we come back, when Film Spotting Nation answers the pressing question that has kept so many of us up at night. Which actress, born in 1990, is your favorite? Seriously, this one was a barn burner. Stay with us.
If you ever change your mind about leaving, leaving me behind, baby, bring it to me. Bring your sweet loving. Bring it all home to me. Yeah.
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 To love cinema is to love Jacques Demy, painting, family, and puzzles. And again, to love Jacques Demy for a long time, until the end.
2008's The Beaches of Agnes, the final film in our six-film Agnes Varda marathon family, apparently, Josh, going to be a running theme throughout this episode. That was Varda herself reflecting on her love of film, including her late husband, Jacques Demy, who gave us one of Josh's all-time favorite films, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
That's where Vin Diesel got all this, the family thing from Varda.
I think that's true. We'll wrap up our Varda marathon next week with The Beaches of Agnes, along with our Varda Marathon Awards. We'll hand out the award for our favorite performance, our favorite picture, and more. Usually, of course, we do have a name for these awards. We could go with The Gleaners because it was so appropriate. Yeah. We talked about how that was actually a metaphor and a word that referenced the very way that she approached cinema. It's appropriate.
We kind of have to, but we're always open to other ideas. There might be another gem out there.
Yeah, and it does give us a great image for our award icon designer, Greg Nemec, who's been listening to the show forever and has designed all of those awards, which you can see at filmspotting.net. But Christopher Reese, longtime listener in Lexington, Kentucky, also threw out a good one, Josh, The Cleos.
That works as
which
well.
I do like. Cleo from 5 to 7, one of Varda's great films, one of her early films, her first probably breakout film. And we both are big fans of that movie. We had seen it, so we did not include it in the marathon. But if you have a better idea, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We will talk about The Beaches of Agnes and share those awards as a separate download for our podcast listeners if you subscribe to the show via iTunes or another podcast app. Next week's show proper, as we mentioned earlier, will be that Jonathan Demme tribute. Our Agnes Varda Marathon is sponsored by our friends at Mubi, cult, classic, independent films from around the world every day. Mubi's experts introduce you to a film they love, and you have a whole month to watch it, so there will always be 30 extraordinary films for you to enjoy.
Listeners of Film Spotting can try Mubi free for a month. Just go to Mubi.com, that's MUBI.com/filmspotting to redeem now.
We have a couple quick notes we wanted to get to, and we wanted to give away some things. First, a final mention, a final plug for your event this weekend. So depending on when you hear this show, you may have already missed it. But Saturday morning, May 6th, you are leading a discussion of 1943's Ernst Lubitsch film Heaven Can Wait.
Yeah, 10 a.m. at the Chicago Cultural Center, free. So just drop on in. And if you're listening to this late and you weren't able to make that, this is all in connection with the music of the Baroque's performance of George Telemann's The Day of Judgment. That is going to be May 14 and 15. We're going to be talking about connections between those two very different but thematically similar works. And again, if you want to just catch the oratorio, that's May 14 and 15.
All the details you would need about this event are available at filmspotting.net/events. That's where we will be posting from here on out all of these types of events and giveaways that we are participating in and that we want you to partake in. we have some stuff to give away, Josh, including a great prize pack here that we were supposed to get to on last week's show, but we are going to make up for it here. We have a La La Land giveaway. It just came out last week on DVD and Blu-ray. If you heard last week's edition of Massacre Theater, or if you haven't yet and you still need to catch up with that episode, once you know what film we were massacring, you can submit your answer via email, and we have an incentive. We are going to give away 5 Blu-ray copies of that much-debated, multi-Oscar-nominated film, along with 2 copies of the film's soundtrack on vinyl. Josh, if
vinyl.
You had this, could you even play it?
No, I had a record player from my parents for a while, and it just, we didn't have space for it anymore.
Yeah,
I'm not one of those cool guys who still listens to vinyl, sorry.
Well, there's still some time for us yet, I think. But to lay this out, 3 listeners, and if you've already played Massacre Theater, you are in the hat. You are eligible to win.
That.
Yes, you don't have to re-enter. 3 listeners who submit correct Massacre Theater entries will get copies of the Blu-ray. One will get the Blu-ray and the soundtrack, and one very lucky winner will get the Blu-ray, the soundtrack, and Josh, his or her very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
The grand prize.
So just to get everyone up to speed, we're going to play just a bit of last week's massacre.
Stop 200 years of privilege and tradition. I'd rather have them 3 sheets to the wind on occasion than have a mutiny on my hands.
See, I'm rather understanding of mutinies. Men pressed from their homes, their chosen occupations, confined for months aboard a wooden prison.
I profoundly respect your right to disagree with me here in this cabin, but I can only afford 1 rebel on this ship.
I'm sure we'll have some more comments as we get to the winner on next week's show, but a lot of people pointed out the confusion I caused by doing my British voice as also my feminine voice.
Yeah, well, those are one and the same for you.
Apparently, I think all British men are very effeminate.
I wasn't going to say it, but I found that a little insulting.
That massacre was part of last week's show that included a very fun top 5, we think anyway, movie expeditions that we'd sign up for. That was along with a review of James Gray's The Lost City of Z. So if you haven't already, submit your Massacre Theater entry to feedback@filmspotting.net by Monday, May 8th, for your chance to win. We also have copies to give away, Josh, of I Am Not Your Negro, Raoul Peck's Oscar-nominated documentary from last year. I enjoyed this film, and I know you did catch up with it.
I did, absolutely. This is the one. I didn't see it until a few days before I actually saw Get Out.
That's right. You referenced it in the setup.
Those two seen in conjunction were really fascinating. So, yeah, this is a really standout documentary.
It is. We're very proud to give away these 2 DVD copies, all the details about how to enter to win those. Again, filmspotting.net/events. And finally, as it came up last week with Steve Procopi, a.k.a. Capone, when we previewed the upcoming Chicago Critics Film Festival, we've got passes for the latest Sam Elliott film. It's called The Hero. It's going to be playing at the Chicago Critics Film Festival. It's the 5th year of it, May 14th at 7 p.m. It's a film about an aging actor. That's Elliott, who tries to reconcile with his estranged daughter. Steve Procopi was very high on this movie, and all you have to do to enter to win that is send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, with The Hero in the subject line, and tell us your favorite Sam Elliott performance. You do also have to include your full name, because we're going to put you on the guest list for this film, so please do include that. But just tell us your favorite Sam Elliott performance. And Josh, so far, we've gotten some great entries. I wanted to share a few.
So we heard from Jamie Evans, who suggested Kermit Newman in The Contender.
I completely forgot about Sam Elliott in that film. He's very good.
Anthony Gagliardi and Han Huey and Trey Chambers all said Virgil Earp in Tombstone.
Love that
Trey
film.
Says this, my favorite Sam Elliott performance is Virgil Earp. He embodies cool as always, but also utters one of the only lines in any movie that I've never understood. He says of his wife, maiden name was Sullivan, and everyone laughs. Why is that funny? Maybe the whole cast is just afraid of Sam Elliott.
Maybe so, and that's as good an explanation as any I can come up with. If you know any of the thinking behind that line, other than, I don't know, making fun of Irish people, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net, and let us in on the joke. Ben pointed out Ron Dunn from Parks and Rec, and Paul Stone, I love this, Gar in Mask, the 1985 film with Eric Stoltz and Cher. Did you see that movie, Josh?
I saw it probably late 80s, yes. Vague memories, no memories of Sam Elliott.
Okay, I watched Mask probably 100 times when I was a kid.
Holy
it was just
cow.
On all the time. It was one of those films. I think it was on HBO. I was always into it. Stoltz, very good. Cher, very good. I definitely remember Gar because he is one of those characters who has a relationship with Cher's character and is kind of a surrogate father to Eric Stoltz's Rocky. And when he disappears, I think they get into a fight and they go their separate ways. And when he comes back later in the film, and I remember it very vividly when we cut to that close-up of Rocky, and he says, Gar, when he sees him. And I'm like, Gar's back. I was as excited as Rocky Dennis was.
Did you do a little fist pump?
Probably.
All right.
Probably. I don't know if fist pumps were a thing way back when.
You started them, maybe.
Yeah, when I was watching this movie. So, if you missed any of that, if you just couldn't keep track of all those details, that's fine. All those giveaways.
We're like a game show.
I'll say it again, filmspotting.net/events. We also wanted to mention a film that we talked about, when was it? Last October. It was here at the Chicago International Film Festival, and it's now being released in limited release, including here in Chicago. It's the Finnish film, The Happiest Day in the Life of Olli Maki. This is a film we both recommend.
Yeah, and I'll give you the plot synopsis and then say the wonderful thing about it is it's nothing like what you expect from hearing this. It's basically a dramatization of the 1962 showdown between the Finnish boxer of the title, played by Jarkko Lahti, and this visiting American champion, Davy Moore. So this really happened, and this is a black and white take on this. But what it ends up being, I think we both found, is a very affecting romance. This boxer, Olli Maki, turns out to be more interested in, he strikes up a relationship with a woman he meets at a wedding early on in the film. And it's all about sort of his sense of commitment and how he takes pride as a boxer, but doesn't entirely define himself as a boxer. And just watching these two characters as people who just thoroughly enjoy being together, spending time with each other, was very moving. So it's beautifully shot, as I said, I think in black and white.
Yep.
So yeah, there's a lot to recommend this one.
Yeah, I almost wonder if it should be a Golden Brick contender because it shows, I think, a distinct style in the way it uses that black and white. And in terms of just a director seeming to be very much in control of his subject matter and the performances, I would give a lot of credit to the director, Juho Kuusmanen. This is the first film we've seen by him. He made one other film, The Painting Sellers, in 2010 that's 58 minutes, and then he has other shorts. So I think this is his first full-length feature film, and it is a good one. As we said, it's available now in limited release if you get a chance to see it. Jim Pellini is the listener who also came up on last week's show, I think, Josh, in the podcast, when I mentioned that he sent me a gift through iTunes if I wanted to relive one of my favorite movies from the 80s, Vision Quest, starring Matthew Modine. And I understand that Jim decided to send you a gift as well.
So I got an email from Jim today, and he's gifted me with other iTunes films.
Oh, okay. I thought I was special, but
none quite in the same stature as Vision Quest.
No, probably not.
Here's what I'm wondering. So as we all know, I lost Film Spotted Madness, my predictive bracket. I came in last. Usually the punishment, well, usually, this is the second year I've had to do this punishment, was to watch a Netflix Adam Sandler film. So
Sandy Wexler.
Sandy Wexler was on deck. I can't say when I was exactly planning to watch this, but at some point I was going to. What do you think about switching in Vision Quest? Would that be all right?
See, I thought for sure Sam put you up to that because he was all about trying to not punish you. He wanted you to get something worthwhile out of this experience if you were going to be forced to watch a film. I think you would definitely be getting something worthwhile out of watching Vision Quest. So no, that does not count as a punishment.
Come on.
You will watch Sandy Wexler. You will tell us about Sandy Wexler, which will in turn punish all of us. But I don't care. It will be worth it to hear you talk about it after having sat through it.
Do I have – you seem to digitally scoff when you messaged me and said, when are you going to watch Sandy Wexler? Well, and I said, well, I have till the end of the year, right? And I don't remember your exact response, but I could hear the scoffing.
Uh-huh.
Why don't I have till the end of the year? I mean, what's the rush?
I suppose there isn't. I just love that you're putting it off, that you're giving yourself that much of a window to watch this film. Last time, I mean, we're only going off the precedent of last time. I think you watched The Ridiculous Six within a couple of weeks. So I guess I just expected that again. That same commitment.
Things are a little tight right now. It's not going to happen in a couple of weeks. I should probably get it done before the year-end rush of screeners.
Yeah.
Because it would be really a shame if I had to forego like something like Tony Erdman because I needed to watch Sandy Wexler.
For sure.
All right. I'll get to it.
Okay. Well, let's get to the polls and the results of the poll question that we have undoubtedly overhyped by now.
Good morning, everyone. Sun is shining, and I definitely need my coffee. We are in my third week of transparency, and we're up to 2,308,007 viewers. Wow. Did I tell you guys I'm not a morning person?
So the good news, Josh, we now know Film Spotting listeners' favorite actress who was born in 1990. The bad news, it's not the always delightful Emma Watson. Though I say it's bad news, neither of us voted for Emma Watson,
as I recall,
in this poll. That was Watson in a clip from The Circle, which opened last weekend. For this week, anyway, Watson starring in two films in the box office top 10, Beauty and the Beast, still there. Of course, currently 2017's worldwide box office champ. And we were planning to see James Ponsoldt's The Circle, and we, I suppose, got distracted by Guardians and a few other things on our plates. It also stars Tom Hanks and John Boyega. We had high hopes for the movie based on a Dave Eggers story. Middling reviews so far and not a huge audience turnout either. So nothing really propelling us to probably seek out The Circle.
Poor Emma Watson. Wait till she hears also now that she lost this poll.
But did she come in last? Our Watson-inspired question. You've got four movies to choose from. The only thing you know about them is that they star one of these 1990-born actresses. Whose movie do you choose? The options: Jennifer Lawrence, Margot Robbie, Kristen Stewart, Emma Watson.
So Robbie actually came in last with 11% of the vote, but it was tight there at the bottom. Emma Watson only received 13% of the vote. Kind of surprising. Neck and neck, pretty much the whole way through.
Wow.
We have to go to, we have to use decimal points this time. Ooh, exciting. I love it when we have to use decimal points. In second place, with 37.65% of the vote, Kristen Stewart. Mm. Jennifer Lawrence pulls it out, 38.33% of the vote.
J-Law takes down K-Stew. Over 1,500 votes cast, only 10 votes separating those two. Now, Sam, who came up with this poll question, and congratulations, Sam. We love when they are close like this and when they justify the question, as arbitrary as it might seem when you came up with it. He pointed out to me behind the scenes, Josh, that he did screw up, and a better entry into this than Margot Robbie, I would say, would have been another actress who, if I remember correctly, not born in 1990, but I think born in 89. So it's right there and it would have worked. Brie Larson.
No, has to be born in 1990.
Okay, but for the sake of argument,
would she have done better in this poll? No. I think
she still would have gotten beat by Jennifer Lawrence and Kristen Stewart.
Right. I think she would probably have landed squarely in the middle if we added her and kept five.
Okay.
That's my prediction.
So she's not eligible because she was born in 1989. In fact,
December 31.
October 1. So didn't quite miss it that closely, Josh. But we've got some good feedback on this poll. We start with Andy Mitchell.
I haven't seen any of Robbie's work outside of her cameo in The Big Short, which is some of her finest bathtub work to date, nor have I seen Watson's work in a film outside of Hogwarts. Therefore, like a lot of us, this comes down to a choice between Lawrence and Stewart. I like Lawrence's past movies more than Stewart's, but since Lawrence is such a big movie star now, there's no telling whether this mystery film will be something in the Silver Linings playbook realm or another shrug-inducing big-budget franchise. Call it recency bias, but after your Kristen Stewart episode, I've come to appreciate her enigmatic qualities and all the interesting choices she's made since Twilight. I feel like even if I don't love her next film, she'll give me something I can think about a little more than the other three.
Andy, certainly with me, it sounds like, then, in voting for Krista Stewart. Michael Locker in El Cerrito, California says, I like all of these actors. I like Watson's maturity and poise and Robbie's smarter, stronger twist on The Bombshell. I especially like Lawrence, who knocked us all back with Winter's Bone and has maintained an aura of make-it-look-easy command of her craft ever since. She's utterly reliable, cool, and often the strongest thing in her films. But if, as the question suggests, we're guessing which mystery film by one of these four is the best bet for a night at the Cineplex, it's the increasingly impressive, enigmatic Ms. Stewart, full stop. I didn't give two craps about the Twilight films, but after catching one or two of them in a late-night channel surfing episode, it's hard to deny she brought a certain sophistication to that vapid material. But it's her post-scandal reinvention that really seals the deal. Guys, I like Emma, Margot, and the inestimable J-Law, but take the last 3 years of pictures from each, none of them is as complete and weirdly turkey-free a collection of films as Kristen Stewart has produced during that run. It's not even close. Bang on, Bella. You have my attention.
One more note here from Kevin. I need to see a Kristen Stewart movie made by Olivier Assayas. Until then, Jennifer Lawrence. Yeah, okay. That probably would affect your view, Kevin.
I think it would. That brings us to this week's poll question, and we are segueing here into our summer movie preview. The subject, big budget, high profile, summer 2017 movies that we're not all that excited about. This is another Sam question, and you can tell because Sam, being the guy who many years ago came up with the idea of always starting a review, no matter how much we hated the film, with something we liked about it, something we probably should have applied to our review of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
We got around to being positive.
Yeah, I suppose, but we could have listened to Sam, even though he's nowhere in the room. His voice was still ringing in my ears. He threw out these options for movies that, to be honest, we probably will skip altogether. But with that in mind, we want to know which ones we'll probably feel guilty about later. So these summer 2017 movies look pretty bad. Which one are we probably underestimating?
Could it be Baywatch? I think you pretty much know what that's about. Here's an interesting fact, though. It's directed by Seth Gordon, he of the documentary King of Kong, Fistful of Quarters.
And we'll just look over Horrible Bosses and Identity Thief.
Oh, yeah.
We'll just pretend those didn't happen.
Those two. Okay. How about King Arthur, Legend of the Sword? Charlie Hunnam.
Your
favorite. Who wants more Charlie Hunnam?
I do.
You got him here.
Sign me up.
Directed by Guy Ritchie. The Mummy. Man, I saw the trailer for this one with Tom Cruise. Mm-hmm. I guess this is a continuation of the Brendan Fraser thing, but it looked much more like a horror film. Pirates of the Caribbean is back. Adam.
So I didn't even know if we wanted to include this one in the poll. How do you feel about it? I was going to omit it.
Because
how can anybody be excited about this film or think that we might underestimate it?
That's not the question. The question is, might it? We'll get to it when we make our picks. This is Pirates of the Caribbean number 14.
I love it.
Okay. One more here. After Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Uh-huh.
That's what this is called, Adam.
That was the name of number two.
Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. This is from Luc Besson, and it looks to be, what was the Jupiter Ascending? It's got a little Jupiter Ascending to it,
sure.
Maybe more Fifth Element look to it. So, you know, that sort of thing. And then we're going to give you one option in this poll.
I have a feeling this one might win.
No, it's fine. You can skip these.
Okay, so give us a free pass to skip these. We won't feel any guilt whatsoever. If one of these films does win, though, we might just review it. We'll add it to Sandy Wexler. Will we force ourselves to go to the theater?
This will be your
Sandy Wexler. We'll blame our listeners. Okay, it'll be my Sandy Wexler. Now that means everyone's going to vote Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Yes.
If winning it means I'll see it. I'm telling you right now that if that one wins, I'll quit the show.
Wow.
Not only will I not see
it. You feel very strong.
Great, now more people are going to vote for it. I'm not helping my cause here at all. Okay, Josh, so of these options.
A lot of pirates hate.
Baywatch, King Arthur, The Mummy.
Yeah.
Pirates, Valerian, or no, it's fine. Skip all of them. What do you say?
Which one might we be underestimating? I do think it might be Pirates, if only because it has...
No way!
Javier Bardem is the bad guy?
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, he could save a movie.
That's really your
as
answer.
As the bad guy?
That's really your
answer.
What
else am I going to go with? King Arthur? Baywatch?
Yes. What
are you going with?
Yes, Baywatch.
Oh, come on.
No, first of all, Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
The 21 Jump Street thing, they did.
I get it. But in terms of actually providing a few laughs, yes, we know Dwayne The Rock Johnson is a charismatic presence, very funny, will have just the right bit of winking at the audience to pull off this role and this film. Zac Efron is a very funny comedic actor.
I like Zac Efron.
He's very good. And I am going to overlook Horrible Bosses and Identity Thief, which, in fairness, I've never seen. And just look at Seth Gordon, director of the great doc, King of Kong, Fistful of Quarters. There's no doubt that of those films, that is the only one that might actually get my butt in a seat.
Baywatch is being perfectly estimated, let me assure you.
Okay. Well, we'd love to know what you think. Vote now at filmspotting.net. And if you leave a comment, and we hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from.
So it's raining and barely 40 degrees here in Chicago, which can only mean one thing. Summer is around the corner, Adam. Our top five questions about the summer movie season are next. Stay with us.
Hey, Adam and Josh, Kenny Meyer from Boulder, Colorado. Just calling in with my question of the summer. I'm wondering if the success of A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is going to be good for Anna Lily Amirpour. I saw that she has a dystopian Western cannibal movie coming out at the end of June. And check out this cast. You got Keanu Reeves, Jim Carrey, Giovanni Ribisi, Diego Luna. That's a lot of stars in a second feature from an independent Iranian vampire story filmmaker. So I'm just wondering if Hollywood is going to corrupt this exciting new filmmaker, or she's going to rise to the challenge. I'm just hoping that kind of the mystery and magic of Girl Walks Home Alone at Night will continue. And keep up the work. Good work, guys. Talk to you soon.
That was Kenny Meyer, he of Massacre Theater fame from our last live show when we shared our favorite scenes of the year at our 2016 Rap Party Live.
Acquitted himself nicely on stage.
He did very well. Came all the way from Colorado. Yes, Jamie was dragged on stage and played along, and we appreciate that. And we appreciate Kenny's pick there for one of the films he's most anticipating, his number one most anticipated film of the summer. It is Anna Lily Amrapour's The Bad Batch. And this one, Josh, I'm with him. It didn't quite make my top five or even my top 10, but based just on the plot summary alone, how could you not be intrigued by this movie?
And the fact that Jim Carrey is in it. How bizarre is that?
Right.
I'm excited about this too. And it'll give me a good excuse to finally catch up with A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night,
yes,
which I have yet to see. So.
Yeah. Me too. Really a big regret there for me as well. And a movie about a community of cannibals. I don't know why that sounds so intriguing to me, Josh, but we'll find out if the movie is a tasty one.
No.
Professional.
No.
Professional there.
Sam.
Professional play on words.
Cut, Sam.
June 23rd, The Bad Batch comes out. Let's get to our top five. We're sharing our most anticipated movies, but we're doing it our way. We are coming at it in the form of questions we have about the summer movie season. And we didn't really talk about this. We didn't set aside any movies as a group, but I will mention some that I have excluded because they were part of our 2017 movie preview. Did you take a similar approach when we looked at the whole year back, I think, in February?
I did that quickly in my head. I didn't go back and look at my list, but I'm pretty sure I avoided those.
Okay, so movies that are coming out this summer, you won't hear me talk about here, even though I am excited to see them. The Dark Tower, August 4th. The Untitled Detroit Project, which is now titled Detroit, from Catherine Bigelow. That's also out August 4th. The Trip to Spain is out August 11th. And Logan Lucky, the latest from Steven Soderbergh, is out August 18th. So a good spate of films there coming out just in the month of August alone. Another one I excluded just because, well, it's obvious, and we excluded it last time, Dunkirk, the latest from Christopher Nolan. So you won't hear any of those films mentioned, but, well, I guess you did just hear them mentioned. Look at how I did that, Josh. Also a professional move. How did you approach this list?
Well, listen to me being so professional. I'm squeezing four titles into my number five question.
Okay.
It's which small Sundance film is going to break out big? Band-Aid, Beatrice at Dinner, Ingrid Goes West, Landline. I picked these four because I happened to see them at Sundance, and I liked each of them to varying degrees. So here they are. Band-Aid was written and directed by Zoe Lister-Jones, who also stars as one half of a squabbling married couple who starts a garage band as marital therapy. At Sundance, I said it's kind of like if John Carney's Once had gotten married and moved to L.A. That might be a little too high a praise
depending
on how you feel about John Carney's Once, if you really love it. I don't think it quite hits that level, but it's got a little bit of that flair. Beatrice at Dinner. This is from Cedar Rapids director Miguel Arteta. I'm
sure
even he doesn't bill himself that way, but
I knew this one had to come up.
I like to bill him
on your
that
list.
Way. Salma Hayek stars as a masseuse whose car breaks down at a wealthy client's estate, resulting in her being invited to a waspy dinner party. It is funny, but it's not as broad as Cedar Rapids. Hayek is amazing in it. That opens June 9. Band-Aid, I should have said, is June 2. Ingrid Goes West, Aubrey Plaza as a stalker of an Instagram star played by Elizabeth Olsen. So this is sort of a Rupert Pupkin for our social media age, opens August 4. And then Landline is Gillian Robespierre's follow-up to Obvious Child.
Mm-hmm.
This also stars Jenny Slate. It's set in the 1990s. She plays a young woman whose own relationship is faltering as her parents are going through a marital crisis. Edie Falco steals this one as her mother. It opens July 21. All right, so my prediction, my answer.
Yeah.
Which one of these is going to break out big? My heart says Beatrice at Dinner. It is the one I enjoyed the most. I think Band-Aid, though, has the most likely chance of doing that.
Okay. I want to see all four of those movies, and we'll see where I fall on that question. Josh, my number five is inspired by another little Sundance movie. The question is, will the best summer 2017 movie be a summer 1991 movie? That film, Terminator 2, Judgment Day 3D.
Ooh.
It comes out August 25th. That's right, 26 years after its release, we are going to see James Cameron's action classic back on the big screen, though I will have to don those 3D glasses again. And doing it for Guardians was the first time I had done it in probably like 3 years. Honestly, I've avoided it. I don't know. Maybe I've just been missing all the pre-screenings that forced us to see it in 3D. I don't go ever to a 3D film.
Yeah, so, me either.
But I would go see this in 3D because it's T2.
I'm excited about it just for a chance to see it on the big screen. Yes. I don't even need the 3D. But
did you see it on the big screen in 91? Because I remember
doing it. Yeah, I did.
Everyone listening, I know, is fully aware that August 29th is my birthday. They're also aware that it's the day Skynet became self-aware.
Coincidence?
Maybe, maybe not. But as I was preparing for this list and I would watch clips and various scenes from T2 online, I haven't seen it in its entirety since 1991. Everything remarkably holds up. The action scenes are really well choreographed. The effects all completely hold up, which isn't a surprise really coming from James Cameron, but maybe I was a little bit surprised, honestly, watching it 26 years later. And maybe at the end of the day, Josh, it's just about getting a taste of James Cameron's greatness that will help me deal with the fact that I've got 17 more Avatar movies lined up between now and 2025.
Huh?
Something like that. It's close anyway. But this will remind us all of what this guy really was capable of with movies like Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, and T2.
You got to get back on board with Avatar. It's really
never
improperly maligned film. Hmm. And I'll help you with that before Avatar 2 comes out.
I'll watch any of the Pirates of the Caribbean sequels before I'll watch Avatar.
You are so off base. What has Guardians done to you? All right, number four for me. How strong are John Boyega's acting chops? So Boyega, he broke out, of course, in The Force Awakens. A lot of us remember him from the smart and funny 2011 alien invasion movie Attack the Block. Now, in both of those films, he did have serious moments, but he was also involved in a lot of action and provided a significant amount of comic relief. I can't report how he was in The Circle, which just opened last weekend, but I am very curious to see him in the film you mentioned, Adam, Catherine Bigelow's Detroit. This is her recreation of a 1967 police raid, I believe, that led to a citizen uprising. So this is, you know, I'm assuming going to be pretty straightforward, serious stuff. We'll see what Boyega brings to it. It does open August 4.
Can't wait. My number four is, can director Taylor Sheridan follow-up screenwriter Taylor Sheridan's acclaim work on Hell or High Water? His directing debut is Wind River, which comes out August 4th. Another question I suppose I could pose is, can an actor who got his start in an episode of Walker, Texas Ranger in 1995 go on to be an Oscar-winning director? Because that's Taylor Sheridan. He was almost an Oscar-winning screenwriter. He did lose out to Kenneth Lonergan's Manchester by the Sea last year, and I suppose I could tolerate that. But Sheridan started as an actor. He's got 21 credits listed on IMDb, most of them TV credits. But he had his breakout in 2015 with Sicario, and then in 2016, Hell or High Water, which was absolutely one of my top five favorite scripts of the year. And I almost talked about this moment. I don't think I did, but I know I wanted to bring it up during our wrap party when we shared our scenes of the year, because one of my favorite moments and one of the reasons I'm excited about Sheridan as a filmmaker goes back to one of the best scenes in Hell or High Water. And I think there's a lot of good scenes in that movie, but it's when we see Chris Pine sit down with his son about halfway or three quarters of the way through the film. And he sits there and enumerates for him how he really is a bad guy, and please don't be like me. And then he tries to get him to drink a beer with him.
Mm-hmm.
And the son points out that you sit here and tell me to not make the same mistakes as you, and then you offer me a beer. And I think in another more cliche movie, that would have been this really nice father-son bonding moment. And we probably would have even bought it, because we've seen so many moments like that before. And we know that they're probably not going to see each other again. Maybe they will, maybe not. So they have this one moment together. But the fact that Sheridan subverted all of that in that moment, I thought was really wonderful. And you look at the performances that came out of that movie. Obviously, we have to give the director, David McKenzie, a lot of credit for those performances and the actors, undoubtedly. But it goes back to that script and what they were working from. Pine gives maybe the best performance of his career. Ben Foster actually dialed back a little bit. Wonderful performance. And Jeff Bridges, Oscar nominated, and I think deservedly so. That script for me, just structurally sound, perfect amounts of character development and story and action. And I'm hoping he'll bring that same acuity to Wind River, which stars Elizabeth Olsen and Jeremy Renner. Olsen plays a rookie FBI agent who teams up with Renner's character, who's this local game tracker on a Native American reservation. They're investigating the murder of a girl and trying to avenge that death. Gil Birmingham, who's also so good in Hell or High Water as the partner to Jeff Bridges, he also appears in Wind River. So I'm excited for all those reasons.
Yeah, Wind River also at Sundance. I didn't see it, but did hear good things. All right, my number three question. Has Bong Joon-ho gone touchy-feely with Okja? Is this how we're O-K-J-A?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is the Korean director's follow-up to Snowpiercer. And while that movie and his other films do gleefully mix tone and genre, the teaser trailer I saw for Okja at least suggested this might be almost straight up sentimentality. Hmm. It focuses on this mysterious animal who's cared for by a young girl and who tries to protect it from a large corporation. Mostly, we only see the animal's like big brown eyes, and this had me thinking of something like Dumbo, as if we're going to go in that direction. But I did come across another promo piece that's a fake ad featuring Tilda. Did you see this?
You're stealing my thunder here, Josh.
I'm sorry. I just saw this today. So she's apparently playing the head of the corporation, and she delivers this bizarre graphic speech about pig nightmares.
Hello. I'm Lucy Mirando of the Mirando Corporation. Maybe the Mirando vision has already found its way into your home. There's our organic harvesting and peachy delight baking goods. And don't forget our Happy Pup treats. What a good boy. Then there's the innovative, behind-the-scenes research we conduct over at Mirando Transformatives and the Mirando Animal Wellness Center. My scientists have discovered that while Mirando pigs dream peaceful and lovely dreams, those less fortunate pigs suffer from the most dreadful night terrors. We cannot know for certain what pigs' nightmares are like, but perhaps they're something like this.
So that kind of made me think, we're back on track in bizarre territory here. And maybe Okja, hopefully, will also be not only sentimental, but pretty weird. It's opening on June 28th.
I don't think there's any doubt about that movie being pretty weird, Josh. Okay, my number three. I have a question about this movie, but one of our listeners, Ben, has his own.
Hey, Adam and Josh. Ben Holler from North Hollywood, California here with my big question of the summer, which is, will The Big Sick be our first breakout romantic comedy in a long time? For those who don't know, The Big Sick is written and starring Kumail Nanjiani of Silicon Valley fame. I've been a huge fan of Kumail for a while, particularly his podcast, The Indoor Kids, which is co-hosted by his wife, Emily Gordon, whom the film is about. Kumail has told the story of their romance before on several occasions, and let's just say, it got a little dusty in my house listening to Kumail tell his story, so I can't imagine how much the film itself will move me. So yeah, I have no fears about this being an excellent film, heck, it was bought by Amazon for $12 million, but it is opening against War of the Planet of the Apes of all things. I really hope people will give this interracial rom-com a chance, because do we really have to see apes? Okay, admittedly, I will probably see Apes first, but I will definitely see The Big Sick the next day, and I really hope others do as well. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. The summer is pretty interesting, so can't wait to hear your thoughts and hope some of my own questions are some of yours. Talk to you later.
So Ben there talking about Kumail Nanjiani and his film The Big Sick, which comes out June 23rd. I'm surprised, actually. Maybe it's because you knew I would bring this film up. You didn't include it in that list of breakout Sundance hits because it was a huge hit there.
And I didn't get to see it there, so that's the reason I didn't, yeah.
But it did win the audience award. My question is much, much more insufferable than Ben's. It is, what aren't Grinnell College grads capable of, Josh?
Oh, man.
What can't we do? What can't we do? Kumail, the class of 01, I believe he arrived the fall right after I left. So never cross paths with Kumail, but we do have one friend in common. He is, as Ben noted, the host of the Indoor Kids podcast, also the X-Files. He's so good as Dinesh on Silicon Valley. I love that show on HBO. The stand-up of his that I've seen is really good, and I'll throw out there that he's a great Twitter follow, too, if you're not already following Kumail. But I am dying, I guess, to see if this is a movie that lives up to all of that Sundance hype. And the story interests me as well, based on his real-life romance with his future wife, Emily V. Gordon. And it's very much about the culture clash, her being this white American from North Carolina, and he's a guy from Pakistan originally, and throw into the mix the fact that she at some point does come down with an illness. And that makes things even more complicated, especially with her parents, who are played by Holly Hunter and Ray Romano. Holly Hunter, almost always great in anything she does, and this may be a bit of a departure, maybe a more serious role for Ray Romano. I'm curious to see his performance. Going back to Ben's original question, what was the last great romantic comedy? I did some quick Google searches today to see what movies others categorize as recent romantic comedies, and here are some titles. Josh, does Her count as a romantic comedy? Knocked Up, maybe, 2007, those Apatow films, Enough Said, a movie we both loved, an adult romantic comedy, not what we're maybe used to seeing with characters the age of Julia Louis-Dreyfus and James Gandolfini in that film, Adventureland, maybe Silver Linings Playbook, if that was a film you went for. It's a tough genre, I think, to define in some ways. I'm sure there are conventions that many people have laid out and we could lay out here, but you could argue that My Beloved Sing Street is a romantic comedy. You could even argue that Everybody Wants Some, that Linklater film, is some variation on a romantic comedy. So I don't know the answer to that question, but I do want to see what this really talented stand-up comedian, writer, and actor is going to do now as a director.
I'm going to vote for Enough Said on that list and also throw in maybe Chris Rock's top five, kind of works that way, from 2014. But Adam, I hope you're also donating, you know, like actual money to your alma mater, not just these mentions don't count. As,
I just paid off my student loans a year ago, and I'm not even joking.
Get ready for the letters.
Nope.
They're going to start rolling in.
They're not getting any more from me until my children go there.
All right. Number two for me. Can Brad Pitt carry a comedy? The inverse of my John Boyega question.
I can answer that for you right now. No.
You don't think so?
No.
Well, you don't even think
but
he's funny.
But I want to see the film.
You don't even think he's funny in his supporting comic performances. I think he's great. That's what he's done with comedy mostly, is stuff like Burn After Reading, the Ocean's films, supporting parts. His lead roles are usually dramatic. Now, as far as I can tell, he's the focus of War Machine. This is the movie in question here. It also appears to be, from the teaser I saw, a fairly broad satire based on all the grimacing that Pitt's doing in the teaser. He plays an ultra-confident U.S. general who meets his match when he takes command of NATO forces in Afghanistan. Interesting, this is directed by David Michaud of Animal Kingdom and The Rover, so we could kind of ask the same question. Can he direct a comedy? We'll see. His previous films, brawny,
not much
bleak
humor
stuff
in Animal Kingdom and The Rover.
So this is a very interesting experiment going on here. I'm a much bigger fan of Pitt than you, so maybe I'm a little more excited about it. It opens on May 26.
We are here to build, to protect, to support the civilian population. To that end, we must avoid killing it at all costs. We can't help them and kill them at the same time. It just ain't humanly possible. Now.
SWAR's been running 8 years.
I still very much want to see it, and we do plan to review it here on the show, and with it coming out on Netflix as well as in theaters, maybe it's one that a good chunk of our audience can watch along with us. My number two question of the summer movie season, Josh, is in reference to a film you have already mentioned, the movie Okja. Comes out June 28th, Bong Joon-ho. My question, though, do pigs dream of electric meat grinders?
Apparently.
According to Tilda Swinton's Lucy Mirando, they most definitely do, and it is kind of horrifying, but as she tells us in that wonderful clip, that wonderful corporate video, pigs deserve happy dreams, just like the rest of us.
Well, they taste better.
Well said,
That's the
Josh.
Implication, right?
Well said, but Bong Joon-ho is a filmmaker who I think on some level has always made movies about man and monster. Sometimes the monster comes in the form of creatures like the one in The Host. Other times, man is the monster. Memories of murder, mother, Snowpiercer. And Swinton's character in that film is one of those monsters as this dictatorial type figure. What's her name? I think Mason in that film. And she is kind of this cartoonish boss with those buck teeth and those glasses, and she delivers one of the all-time great lines. She says to the unwashed masses, "Know your place, accept your place, be a shoe." And Swinton being Swinton, she just can so totally sell that line. She is so good in that film. And here, my understanding is she actually has two roles in the movie.
I didn't realize
it's a dual role, and I'll always take double the Tilda Swinton.
Absolutely.
Along with her, you've got Jake Gyllenhaal, Paul Dano as well. But I loved Snowpiercer. And yes, this one seems maybe to be a little bit more sentimental than that film, which I don't know if there was much sentiment you could find in that film, maybe by the end of the film. But in that storyline that feels very familiar to us, think about The Iron Giant or any film like that where you have a kid and their creature that they're trying to protect. This somehow just seems all a little bit more surreal and absurd.
More likely than not, it's misdirection, you know, complete misdirection too for the audience, which I can totally see him doing. So yeah, looking forward to that one. All right, my number one question for the summer movie season: will anything in It Comes at Night be as disturbing as Krisha uncorking a wine bottle? Krisha was last year's debut film from Trey Edward Schultz, and many people, myself included, noted how this story of an alcoholic's precarious return to her family for Thanksgiving dinner had horror undertones to it. Schultz has gone all in on that with this follow-up, It Comes at Night. It's about a man, Joel Edgerton, who's holed up in a house with his family, trying to protect them from a mysterious outside threat. So this is being described directly as a psychological horror film. And Krisha, that absolutely was a psychological horror film in many ways. I mean, that scene that was highlighted at our wrap party where Krisha desperately opens and downs the bottle of wine had this palpable sense of terror to it. So I can't wait to see what Schultz does by embracing that fully. And it seems like a natural transition for him to make. So It Comes at Night is opening June 9.
Just going to run through a few things. When we go out during the day, we like to stick to groups just for safety. The red door. It's the only way in and out of the house. It stays closed and locked all the time. I have the keys. It's the only set. Most important thing.
What's he see?
It's okay. Just go inside.
We never go out at night.
So it works out well, depending on your perspective, when we don't coordinate these picks ahead of time, because we cover the same films and then our listeners get to decide who comes up with the better question.
Okay.
My question is, will the supernatural mysterious forces threatening a family in It Comes at Night be as scary and fascinating as the natural mysterious forces that attack the family in Krisha?
Kind of the same question.
Way more wordy, but yes, the exact same question, because as you noted, another family in crisis, a family being threatened, only this time it isn't alcoholism and neglect and all the other forces that more regularly, more normally tear apart families. It is some kind of outside threat. Schultz was a Golden Brick finalist for a very good reason. I think for a lot of people who saw that movie, us included, he's one of the more exciting young filmmakers around. I think about that scene in particular, the one we covered. I think it was one of Michael's choices for music moment.
Yeah, that's right.
When that wine bottle uncorks at our rap party. The way he uses camera and framing and movement to establish that space and a mood and that really creepy tone that turned that family gathering into a horror movie. Now, as you said, Josh, he's actually making a horror movie. So I want to see how that will translate. It is, again, a family in a confined space. And based on what I've seen, a new trailer, not just the teaser, but a full one came out, I think, just yesterday or today as we tape this. So we will link to that in our show notes. On top of everything we just said, the cast, Edgerton's an actor I like. Carmen Ejogo gave one of my favorite performances of last year in Born to Be Blue. Christopher Abbott's a really talented actor who was in James White a couple of years ago. And Riley Keough, who we saw most recently being wasted probably in The Discovery she's very good. So, wonderful cast, great young filmmaker. I don't think anyone who sees the trailer will be disappointed or less enthused about what's coming next from the director of Krisha.
Yeah, and because it's horror, I have avoided the trailer. I just generally try to do that because some of them, I don't know if this one gives a lot away or not, but
no.
So I'm going to go in blind.
I would say it really doesn't, and you know me, I tend to want to not watch them as well, but being my number one, I felt like I wanted to get a sense of what he was doing here, and that only cemented it as my number one choice. Those are our top five questions of the summer movie season. Any honorable mentions? Any great questions you came up with that you had to omit?
My honorable mentions were all squeezed into my number five pick. Right.
Fair enough.
Four films.
Okay, I've just got two. I know everybody listening, at least everybody listening who is a big fan of Edgar Wright, is screaming at their phones or their computer or their radio going, you guys already ignored Baby Driver when you did your year preview. Here you are again getting another chance. Fewer movies, more condensed schedule, and yet no love for Baby Driver, which does come out June 28. I suppose my take on it, Josh, is I don't have a question to ask about this movie.
Yeah.
I'm just really excited to see it.
Yeah, I'm with you, totally.
Now, our production assistant, Jeremy Wellhausen, did come up with a question, and I suppose it works for our purposes, which is, can Edgar Wright, and he threw in Christopher Nolan as well, because of Dunkirk, make a bad movie? A fair question, because neither of them to date, as far as I'm concerned, has made a bad movie, which through 3 to 5 to 7, whatever, any number you get over 3 to not have made a stinker is pretty good.
Yeah. And I was mixed on Interstellar, but by no means would call it a stinker. So yeah, that fits for both of those filmmakers.
Okay. That was my honorable mention number one. My honorable mention number two is, will the Hawkesance continue?
What's he in?
Ethan Hawke. He's in two movies this summer. One of them is Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, July 21st.
Okay.
The Luc Besson, also Dane DeHaan in that movie, and Clive Owen, John Goodman. So it's got a good cast, and we'll see if that's one that we're underestimating. June 16th, he is also in Maudie, where I believe he plays the husband to Sally Hawkins, who, according to the synopsis, is an arthritic Nova Scotia woman who works as a housekeeper while she hones her skills as an artist and eventually becomes a beloved figure in the community.
Very different films there.
Very different films. That's what you can expect from the great Ethan Hawke. Those are my honorable mentions, and those are, again, our top five summer movie questions. We want to know your questions, the movies you're most excited about that are coming out here between May and the end of August. Email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
That's also where you'll find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives. Those are in the show archives. And we also ask that if you're not already following the other Film Spotting family shows, please do that. That's The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find them both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Out in wide release this weekend, nobody is going up against Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. In limited release, David Lynch, The Art Life, An Intimate Journey Through the Formative Years of the Director's Life. The Dinner, which is the latest from director Oren Moverman, who gave us The Messenger and Rampart. Great cast, Richard Gere, Laura Linney, Rebecca Hall, and Steve Coogan. The Happiest Day in the Life of Olemaki, which we mentioned and recommended earlier in the show. Risk, a documentary about WikiLeaks' Julian Assange from director Laura Poitras, who directed the Edward Snowden documentary Citizen Four. And finally, the best named movie that will come out this year, without a doubt, My Entire High School Sinking into the Sea, an animated feature debut from cartoonist Dash Shaw. Our friend Tasha Robinson from The Next Picture Show called it surreal, funny, weird, and bizarrely enjoyable. I watched this movie last night, Josh.
Oh, yeah? And?
Yeah. It's only about 80 minutes, my perfect length for a film.
You even knocked it out in one chunk, I bet.
I did, actually. Didn't have to split it up. Amazing. I'll agree with Tasha. It's certainly surreal, and it's weird, and it is bizarrely enjoyable. Funny, I might go more mildly amusing than full-blown funny there like Tasha did, but I enjoyed the voice work from Jason Schwartzman, Lena Dunham, Alex Karpovsky, and others. That movie out in limited release. And real quick, we did want to throw out there basically an open call. It's May. We're 4 months plus into the movie season, and we really only have one Golden Brick candidate for the year, Raw, a movie which you saw at Sundance. And we have, behind the scenes, been watching a few films. My Entire High School Sinking into the Sea, one of those movies that could have qualified for our criteria, but I've seen some other films that I hoped would fit the bill and just haven't quite done it for me. So we're sitting here with one entry, and we have a lot of the year left, but if there's something out there you think we've overlooked that is a perfect Brit candidate, we'd love to hear it.
I think you're right. I think Olimaki might count, and we should consider that. But because these are films that fly under the radar, we don't always hear of all of them. So any recommendations for ones? Again, the emphasis are on maybe first or second time directors, distinct style to the film itself. They may be taking some risks or doing something different formally, those sorts of movies. So
that's
let us know if you've heard one or seen one that you think might fit the bill.
Next week, we will focus on the late Jonathan Demme. We have a blind spotting review of Something Wild, and we will share our top five Jonathan Demme moments. If you have a favorite Demme moment or scene, leave us a short voicemail, and we may use it on next week's show, 312-264-0744, or send us an MP3 file, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Filmspotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Jeremy Wellhausen. Thanks to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, and special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.